All right. We've done two major surveys in this unit already, prokaryotes in one chapter, and then last time was eukaryotes, but mostly protists. And what is a protist? Exactly. Any eukaryote that is not an animal, a plant, or a fungus. So the chapter was about eukaryotes totally, but it was really focusing on protists more than anything else. Now today, we're going to focus on two major groups of eukaryotes that are not protists, because they are plants or fungi, which officially excludes them from being protists. It might seem that plants and fungi deserve to be together in a chapter because they are so similar. You might think that they are highly related because fungi kind of seem like plants. They grow out of the ground, right? But they're not very highly related, and that's not why we're studying them together in one chapter. If you look at this tree in the first slide, notice that fungi are more related to us animals than they are to plants. And also, as I pointed out last week, plants have as their sister taxon charophyte algae. Remember, we talked about different kinds of algae, which simply is a word that means photosynthetic protist. There are red algae, brown algae, some algae that don't have even algae in their name. And then there are two major groups of green algae, remember, from the tree. The chlorophyte algae that we looked at pictures, those looked very much like plants. But the chlorophyte algae that we looked at are actually not closely related to plants as charophyte algae are, which is why they're in the tree. But back to this fact that fungi are not really plant-like at all. Well, there's one glaring reason for that. What is that? What's the major reason why fungi are not like plants? That's right. What words do we use for things that make their own food? Autotrophs. Plants are autotrophs. Specifically, since they use photosynthesis to make their food, they are specifically photoautotrophs. Remember those different words on that table we looked at? So they are producers, which is another word for autotroph. Plants are. Fungi are not. They, just like us animals, are heterotrophs. They can't make their own food. They have to get their nutrition from other organisms, just like we do. So just in terms of trophic interactions, in terms of nutrition, it should make sense to you that a fungus is more like an animal than it is like a plant. Yes, the lifestyle is different because fungi do stay in place, at least most fungi do, as opposed to animals. Now, why are we called animals? Why are we called animals? Because we are animated. We move around. Unlike a fungus. Right? We don't stay planted in the ground. We go wherever we want. So that is definitely a difference between animals and fungi, even though there are some animals that spend their whole lifetime attached to something. That's really not a huge difference, though. Well, I mean, there isn't a huge difference, though, with respect to eating. Now, we animals eat, and that means we put something into our mouths, right? You might think that when we eat, whatever it is you put in your mouth, that you're putting that into your body. We don't put food into our bodies. And you never should. I mean, to do that, you would have to, like, inject the food into your bloodstream, which I'm not recommending you do. We don't put food into our bodies. We put food into a tube called the alimentary canal. That is a continuous tube that runs from mouth to anus. It takes twists and turns along the way, but it's one long tube. And our body, which is made up of the cells of our body, is really just a mass of cells that surround that tube. And notice, you know, I open my mouth, that's continuous with the air around me. Well, the entire contents of the alimentary canal, all the way from mouth to anus, is really outside of the body. And the body's just wrapped around that, right? Kind of like a hole in a bagel. You stick your finger through the hole in the bagel, you're not sticking your finger into the bagel. Right? You'd have to put it into the stuff that makes up the bagel, the stuff you eat, for it to be in the body of the bagel. So, when we eat, we're really just putting big chunks of stuff that contain nutrients, mainly the bodies of other organisms, into that alimentary canal, and then we have to digest it first so that we can break it into small enough molecules, the individual subunits like amino acids from proteins, nucleotides from nucleic acids, monosaccharides from polysaccharides, fatty acids and glycerol from fats. Those are all small enough molecules to then be put into the body. To get into the body, you need to penetrate a cell membrane and go into the cells of the body. That happens as the second major function of the digestive system after digestion, which is absorption. We have to digest simply so that we can absorb. And that's when it finally enters the body. By then it's no longer food, right? It's just molecules. Doing all of that digestion, breaking big things into smaller and smaller chunks, requires enzymes, proteins acting as catalysts to break these bonds. And so, cells lining our digestive tract or alimentary canal secrete these enzymes outside of our body into that tunnel so that it can mix with the food, break it into small enough chunks so that it can then be absorbed. All right? Well, fungi do exactly the same thing. They don't have an alimentary canal. They live on their food. And they digest what they're living on by secreting enzymes out of their body onto that food, breaking it into molecules, which then get absorbed into the body of the fungus. So they do exactly the same thing we do, except by having an alimentary canal and being animated creatures, animals, we don't have to wait around for that digestion to occur where we get that food. We put it in the alimentary canal, then walk away and let the digestion take place because we're carrying that process with us. Fungi, on the other hand, stay in place. But they really do the same thing. So it's not similarity between fungi and plants that we put them together in this chapter. The reason that they're put together in the chapter, which is not just for convenience either, is that plants and animals co-evolved. They both appeared on land about the same time, and they have co-evolved, affecting each other's evolutionary trajectories since then, and continue to. So they have a very close relationship between each other, even though they're not very similar phylogenetically. They're not highly related. So the rest of the chapter is going to be about fungi and plants both, but we're kind of going to go back and forth between the two here and there. By the way, I already mentioned again that charophyte algae are the closest relatives to plants. You can see that on this phylogenetic tree. There's various bits of evidence pointing to that being true, but slide 2 shows you an important bit of molecular evidence that makes us believe this. You don't really see much in this figure, but you can kind of, because this is really, really close up electron microscopy. This is at the molecular level. So the surface, the cell whose surface we're looking at right here, would be much, much bigger than this building. We're just looking at a couple rings of proteins in the plasma membrane of this cell. And you can make out that they're rings. Well, plants and charophyte algae have in common that they have cell walls. Well, fungi have cell walls as well, as in other things do, like bacteria, for instance. But not all cell walls are the same. They're built out of different things. Like fungi, for instance, has a bunch of chitin, which is a polysaccharide, in their cell walls, whereas plants and algae don't. Plants and charophyte algae, the ones that they're related to, both have cell walls made out of a lot of cellulose, a structural polysaccharide. So that itself goes along with the way the tree's drawn, right? They have that in common. Well, they're not the only things that have cellulose in their cell walls. But cellulose is, what is cellulose? I just told you that it's a structural polysaccharide. As any polysaccharide, that means it's built by hooking together a bunch of monosaccharides, right? But in the specific case of cellulose, the monosaccharides that are used are what? What are the monosaccharides? Just many, many copies of the same monosaccharide that are strung together to make cellulose. Does anyone know? What is it? Well, yes, monosaccharides are sugars, but there are different kinds, right? Fructose, glucose. There's many, many different kinds of monosaccharides, and they all could be used as monomers to build a polymer, a polysaccharide. But in the specific case of cellulose, it's only one that's used, and that is glucose. Actually, it's the same thing that's used to make starch, which is not a structural polysaccharide, but a storage polysaccharide. The difference is a storage polysaccharide is built in order to store those glucoses for later use as fuel, whereas a structural polysaccharide is built to be strong, to be a building material. But anyway, it's a bunch of glucoses. If you're making a cell wall out of a polysaccharide like cellulose, you need to build that with the help of the cellular machinery, right? But it needs to be laid down outside of the cell because that's where the cell wall is. Remember that cell wall is, if a cell has it, a cell wall is exterior to the plasma membrane. So these things, these long cellulose fibers that make up the cell wall, need to be strung out of the cell as it's being built. Because you can't just export a bunch of glucoses, they won't self-assemble outside of the cell. The cell has to do that. And as I said a bit ago, different kinds of cells have used cellulose as their main component of their cell wall, but they make their cellulose a little bit differently. What we see here in two rings are tiny molecular machines that allow these cellulose polymers to be built as they're strung outward so that it can be pumped, become part of the cell wall. Any cell that uses cellulose as cell wall material has to do this in a certain way. But the only kinds of organisms that have these circular arrangements of proteins that act as these cellulose building machines are the charophyte algae and the plants. Other ones they have a similar device, but it's not ringed like this. So this is an important bit of molecular evidence. Now, chlorophyte algae, which are not the very closely related ones, those are the ones we looked at last week, those look like plants simply because they use the same pigment, chlorophyll, that makes them green. Charophyte algae do as well, but they're more closely related as evidenced by this molecular evidence. Now let's go to three. Plants, first of all, is a true clade. It's a monophyletic group. Same is true for animals and fungi, for that matter. Those are all true clades. So there's only one phylogenetic group of plants. And all members of the taxon that we call plants have some certain things in common. One of which I'm going to explain eventually, but I want to give you some background information before I explain what it's called. This is the life cycle of a plant that we see on the top of the slide. And it's typical, in a lot of ways, of any sexual species, whether it's a plant or not. I don't know whether you learned this in 181 or not. You did if you took it from me, but most of you didn't take it from me. Any sexual species has in its life cycle, or I should say its reproductive life cycle. I'm not talking about just a single organism. I'm talking about from generation to generation. For it to be a sexual species, there has to be the process somewhere in the cycle that actually defines sex, right? And what is the defining process of sex? Fertilization. That's when gametes fuse, two unicellular gametes fuse to make a unicellular zygote, right? That is what makes it sex. But notice, as we've talked about before, I think, in here, that when that happens, fertilization, because it's fusion of two cells, results in a zygote with double the ploidy, right? Each individual gamete has its own chromosomes. Those get combined in the zygote, since it's a fusion of two gametes. Remember what ploidy is? What's the definition of ploidy? Been through this several times already, so you should know the definition of ploidy. Any takers?
Yeah, number of traits.
Not number of traits, no. The number of traits roughly corresponds to the number of genes. Ploidy has to do with chromosomes, not genes. Do you remember what N means?
Number of different chromosomes?
Right. N is the number of different kinds of chromosomes in an organism. And what is that number for humans, for instance? How many different kinds of chromosomes do we have? 23, right. Other organisms have more, some have fewer. Depends on the species. So that's what N is. That's not ploidy. What is ploidy? No, that's it's in a way it's the number of chromosomes, but it's not enough to just say it that way. Ploidy is how many of each type of chromosome a cell has. So humans have 23. Any given species will have a certain number of different types, right? But any given cell is going to have some number of each type of chromosome. in almost all the cells of your body, there are two of each type of chromosome. You have two number ones, two number twos, two number threes, and so on. Right? So that makes your cells diploid cells. Di meaning two. You have two of each type. A haploid cell has only one of each type. So it has n total chromosomes, whereas a diploid cell has 2n. 2 times n, whatever n is. All right? Now, is that clear again? Because you've said previously that you were clear on what it is when we covered it before. And you have a feel for what ploidy is? Okay. Now back to sex. Fertilization, because of how it works, because it's fusing two cells, each with their own set of chromosomes, doubles the ploidy. Right? Sex isn't trying to do that, it just has to because of how it works. It's doing that, I mean, if you want to think of it in terms of goals, it's doing that so that there can be an increase in genetic variability in the population. That's the advantage of combining two individuals' gametes together. But it has the side effect of doubling the ploidy. Now, if that's the only process that occurred each generation in any sexual species, now I'm not talking about just plants yet, any sexual species, if it were just fertilization happening, then the ploidy would double every generation, right? If you have haploid gametes getting together, that would form a diploid zygote and other diploid zygotes in other individuals. And then they would make gametes that were diploid, and those diploid gametes would get together, and the next generation would be tetraploid, having 4 of every chromosome, right? And then the next generation would have 8, and then 16. Well, it's already astounding how many chromosomes we can pack into the nucleus, which is even tinier than the already invisibly small cell. So this would quickly get out of hand. There's no way that you could pack in all those chromosomes if it doubled every generation. And the lineage would go extinct. So sex would not work if you only had fertilization. That's why every sexual species undergoes a generation-to-generation alternation between fertilization, which doubles the ploidy, and another process that undoes that doubling, cuts it back in half, which is meiosis. That's why we have meiosis. That way, from generation to generation, it just goes back and forth between haploid and diploid, and then back to haploid, and then back to diploid, and it doesn't accumulate in the long run. All right? Okay, so that's true of any sexual life cycle. There's going to be meiosis and fertilization, both there. In most animals, maybe even all animals, I say most just to cover my ass, there might be an exception or two, but effectively all animals... Well, let me start over even before we get to animals. So every sexual life cycle has these two processes, but notice that also means there are two stages within the overall life cycle, one that is haploid and one that is diploid. We are living our lives, for instance, as animals, as diploid individuals. And the only haploid part of our life cycle as animals are our gametes, sperm and egg. All right? Every life cycle is going to have a haploid and every sexual life cycle is going to have a haploid and a diploid stage. But in animals, which we're members of, only one of those two stages is multicellular. Right? We live our lives as multicellular diploid individuals. And we make haploid cells that never get past being unicellular. A sperm or an egg is a single cell, and it either dies before ever being used in reproduction, so it remains unicellular, or if it is gotten together, fused by fertilization with another gamete from the opposite sex to make a zygote, then it's no longer a gamete, right? Now it's a diploid cell of the next diploid part of the life cycle. You see what I'm saying? In other words, sperm do not become multicellular haploid individuals. They remain haploid unicellularly. Fungi, which are part of this chapter, are kind of the opposite of that. They also, because they're sexual, have a haploid stage and a diploid stage. But they live their lives as multicellular haploid individuals. You know, you see a mushroom growing in your yard, that's made up of haploid cells. Its body is haploid. And when it makes gametes, it doesn't do so by meiosis because it's already haploid. Doesn't make sense for a haploid cell to enter meiosis, right? Because meiosis cuts the ploidy in half. You're already at having just one of each chromosome. So that since they're already haploid, they make their gametes by mitosis, which just maintains the ploidy. All right? But anyway, when their gametes get together from two different fungi, that produces, via fertilization, a diploid cell called the zygote, just like in us, except that zygote does not then undergo mitosis to become multicellular and diploid like we do. Instead, that zygote immediately, as one cell, undergoes meiosis to become haploid cells, which then undergo mitosis to become individual multicellular haploid fungi. You see the difference there? So they spend their life in the haploid stage, and their diploid stage never gets past the unicellular configuration. Kind of the converse of us, animals. Now we can finally get to plants, which have what is called an alternation of generations. Now don't be confused by this phrase, because I've already used the word alternation. All sexual species undergo the alternation from generation to generation between fertilization and meiosis. That's not what alternation of generations means. Alternation of generations means that plants have multicellularity in both their haploid and their diploid phases, whereas animals and fungi are haploid and diploid both, but only one of those two is multicellular, the other one is unicellular. Okay? So that means for any given plant, there is a haploid version of the plant that is multicellular, not just a single cell, and it is called the gametophyte stage. Notice that underneath the word gametophyte is N. N means haploid, right? Now the word phyte, or the root phyte that gametophyte ends in, P-H-Y-T-E, means plant. Gametophyte literally means gamete-producing plant. So that version of the species, there's two multicellular versions of the species. Whereas for us in fungi, there's only one multicellular version. In plants, there's a multicellular haploid version called the gametophyte, and it produces gametes by mitosis because it's already haploid. Okay? When those gametes from different gametophytes get together, that's fertilization, produces a zygote, which is 2N, just like it does in us. And then that zygote, that unicellular zygote, undergoes mitosis to become multicellular diploid. That's the same species, but now it's a different version of the same species. It's a diploid version called the sporophyte, which literally means spore-producing plant. All right? And the sporophyte generation, then, eventually, certain cells in that multicellular body of the sporophyte undergo meiosis to produce spores, which are haploid, as you'd expect for meiosis output to be, right? Produce haploid spores that then undergo mitosis to become multicellular haploid gametophytes of the next generation. So the real important difference that's different compared to animals or fungi is that there's multicellularity in both stages, both the haploid and the diploid stage. On the bottom, we see that plants have multicellular dependent embryos. Just like we do as animals, by the way. Right? The zygote that we all started out with becomes multicellular by mitosis. Then once it's multicellular, then it's no longer called a zygote. It's called an embryo. In us, it eventually develops into a fetus. But the embryo is within the body of the mother-to-be and is dependent on her. Well, the same thing is true for plants. Those embryos develop inside the body of the previous generation. Okay, let's go on to four. What we are looking at here is just a photograph to show you an example of plants that still exist but that are primitive. Now, the word primitive, you shouldn't put any value judgment to that. Don't think of that as a knock on anyone. Primitive simply means like the ancestors. So when we've talked about the basal taxon in a phylogenetic tree, the basal taxon is primitive. Primitive, far from being an insult, primitive really is kind of a compliment, because it shows that was such a successful lineage that they haven't changed much. Okay, but primitive means more like the ancestor than anyone else in the overall tree. Anyway, the original plants to come into existence evolutionarily are called bryophytes, and we'll talk a lot more about these in a minute. And we're looking, and bryophytes include things like mosses. Here we're looking at a moss, but you need to appreciate that this is extremely close up. It looks kind of like an ordinary plant that you would have as a house plant, maybe, but these are tiny, tiny things. Now, you've seen moss before, you know, when you're not really trying to examine it, you just encounter it by stepping on it or whatever. It just kind of looks like velvet on the ground, right? Well, if you really get in there close and look at it under a dissecting microscope, you see things like this. So this is really, really close up. These are not big plants. Bryophytes can't get really big. They were the first successful plants, first plants to come into existence, but they are constrained in their size. And that's because bryophytes, unlike later plants that came into existence and that overtook them success-wise, bryophytes are non-vascular. Now, what does that phrase mean, non-vascular? Well, it's the opposite of vascular, but what does vascular mean? What is it? No. Vascular is the adjective of vessel. Vascular means having vessels. And so we are vascular creatures as animals, right? We have blood vessels and lymphatic vessels. That's why we can be so big, by the way. And that's why vascular plants, which bryophytes are not, can get big as well. In fact, sequoias are the biggest organisms that have ever lived. They're vascular plants. Why is it that you need to be vascular to be big? Well, by big, I mean big in all three dimensions. you know, tall, wide, and deep all at the same time. If you are such a big creature that in all three dimensions, that means you have a lot of cells in your interior that are nowhere near your surface. The surface cells can exchange materials with the surroundings easily because they're right up against those surroundings. And so diffusion can bring things into and out of the cells. Okay? But if you're one of these deep cells, you still have the requirement of getting necessary things into you and getting rid of wastes, but you're nowhere near a surface. Diffusion works wonderfully well on very short distances. But for a particle to diffuse just from my head to my foot, which is not a very long distance compared to most humans, but just to get from my head to my foot might take decades by diffusion. Much too long for me to remain alive if that's something that I need to get that distance. So by being vascular, we solve this problem. Flowing through the vessels are fluids that act like the surroundings, basically, of cells that are on our surface. Those fluids get brought close enough to cells that diffusion can exchange things between the fluid in the vessels and the cells themselves. We do this with blood, right? Well, plants, vascular plants, do this with xylem and phloem, which are fluids that run through their two major kinds of vessels. The original plants did not have these. This was a later innovation that was hugely successful, and that's why plants eventually got big. But the bryophytes can't be very big, and that's why this is a deceiving picture. These are really small. But also notice that you see two different species. This one that's labeled the sporophyte and this one that's labeled the gametophyte. Those are the two different versions of the same species I was talking about that illustrates alternation of generations. The gametophyte is a multicellular individual made up of haploid cells, and growing out of that individual is a different individual of another generation, a sporophyte that is diploid. And you can tell them apart just by looking at them. They are both multicellular. All right, that's the essence of alternation of generations. In almost all plants that you would think of, just from encountering plants in your life, almost all of the examples of plants nowadays are vascular plants. And even though there is a alternation of generation for them as well, you really only ever see the sporophyte generation because the gametophyte generation lives entirely inside the sporophyte generation. So that's why you don't see two versions of an oak tree species, for instance. It's only the sporophyte you ever see. In bryophytes, though, you see them both as they're equally large, basically, or close to equally large. They're obviously both multicellular. Okay, another thing about this, though, remember I said that the sporophytes are the spore-producing generation, and those spores are produced in things called sporangia, which we're looking at a close-up micrograph of here. Well, in order to be successful on land, which plants had to be in order to be plants, they keep in mind, first of all, that they descended from algal ancestors. They evolved from algae that already were there in the ocean. But that's a hell of a change in lifestyle to go from the ocean, which their algal ancestors did, to living on land. Because land has a lot of things different about it, but one major thing that's different is that life on land, or land, is a desiccating environment. Desiccation means drying out, right? You don't have to worry about drying out when you live in water. But you do if you live in air, because you're continuously losing water, and without water, you're not alive. So to do that, certain problems have to be solved evolutionarily before you can even begin to be a land-dwelling organism. And by the way, think back to when we looked at that chart of the entire history of Earth, the geologic history of Earth, where we have the different eons. Remember, the Hadean is the oldest one. That's without any life. And then at the top of that chart was the Phanerozoic eon, which we're in right now, which is roughly the last 600 million years. Remember that almost all of that chart was really a fanned out of just that the last 600 million years. Well, that's when all of this is happening. When eukaryotes are inhabiting the land 600 million years ago, even a little bit more recently for plants. This is happening all basically at the same time for fungi and for plants. But anyway, they had to deal with the fact that living in air is a desiccating, or you have to get around this desiccation problem. And one thing that was a big evolutionary advantage was a mutation that led to, or a set of mutations maybe, that led to a production of a new polymer called sporopollenin, which you find in the cell walls of certain plant cells. It's not only a polymer, like, you know, there's a lot of polymers, but it's a really stable polymer that does not get degraded. It can last millions of years, actually. That's why we can find fossils of pollen grains, basically. But this sporopollenin was a huge breakthrough evolutionarily because it allowed the case that contains these pollen spores to resist drying out and therefore dying. Resisted desiccation, in other words. Slide 5 is a cartoon of what an early bryophyte might have been. Now, we saw a bryophyte. That was an actual photograph because bryophytes still exist. We still have non-vascular plants. They are the basal group. They just are vastly outnumbered by more successful plants that evolved later. But anyway, this is a picture of what a typical bryophyte might have been when plants were just getting started. So this is not a vascular plant. And what are labeled rhizoids here, you might think of as roots. These are not roots. But the rise part of this word means root. These are not true roots, which is why they're called rhizoids, which means like a root. Oid means like. The reason they're not true roots, like you see in modern plants, is that true roots are vascular. Now, yes, one of the functions of true roots is to hold the plant in place so it doesn't get blown away or whatever. But the more important function of true roots is, because of their vascularity, to bring nutrients and water in from the soil. Rhizoids don't do that. They're just anchoring devices. But that's an advantage. You know, it's important to be able to stay in place for a photosynthetic organism that's collecting the sun. By the way, there are also advantages to being on land. If you're a photosynthetic organism, you're going to be able to much more easily be flooded with light if it doesn't have to go through water to get to you, right? You're right out there in the open. So, by the way, that is really another reason why plants eventually got so big. There is a strong selective advantage to outgrowing your competitors, right? Because the taller you can get, the more you can have direct sunlight and put them in the shade. Okay, so there's strong pressure to get big, but bryophytes couldn't because they're non-vascular. That's why vascularity eventually became such a hit once it evolved into place. So plants are typically highly branched, but this one is slender throughout its whole body, and that's because it's non-vascular. So you can be long, you can be big in one dimension, in other words, as long as you're not also big in the other dimensions. Because even a very long thing, if it's slender, if it's slender in the other two directions, it still has cells that are close to the surface. It's only when you get big in all three dimensions that you need a vascular system. All right, let's switch gears and talk about fungi for a minute. We're on slide 6. On the lower left, we see a typical fungus's body. Now, there's all kinds of different shapes to fungi. Don't think that all fungi are mushrooms. But in any given fungus, or at least multicellular fungus, I should say. By the way, now that I've said that, let me say that most fungi are multicellular. All plants are multicellular. And all animals are multicellular. Not all fungi are multicellular, though, even though most are. What is the general name that we give to a unicellular fungus? It's a word that you know, even if you've never learned it in a biology class. It's called a yeast. That's what a yeast is. It's fungus, but it's just a single cell. And most fungi have a body made of multiple cells, like we see here. And remember I was talking about how fungi obtain their nutrients similar to us, right? Except the difference is that they live on their food rather than carrying their food with them. But they, just like us, they excrete enzymes out of their body onto the food, digest it, and then absorb the smaller molecules. Well, fungi do this using a system of highly branched structures called hyphae. Now, that word is plural. You're talking about just one little filament. The singular is hypha without the E. But these are a bunch of hyphae. And when you consider all those hyphae, that whole network of hyphae, as one big thing, then that is called the mycelium. And so the mycelium is really the interface between the fungus and the food that it lives on. All right? Now, why would the mycelium be made out of these slender and very branching hyphae? Why does it make sense for hyphae to be slender and very branched? Well, think about your own digestive tract. Most of the digestion occurs in the small intestine. And that's where also almost all of the absorption takes place. The absorption is really the important thing, right? Because that's when it finally enters your body. The small intestine is a tube, but if you look at the interior of that tube, the interior lining, the endothelium, it is not just a smooth surface. The lining of the gut, the small intestine, is highly folded. And then on those folds, you have folds on the folds, and then the cells that are on those folds on the folds themselves have folds in their plasma membrane called microvilli. Why do you have so many folds? What does that do for the small intestine? Why does it allow you to absorb more, though? Right. The more folded it is, the more surface area there is. You have to have surface area for there to be contact between, it's called chyme by the time it gets there, but it's food originally. There has to be contact between that stuff that's outside of your body and the cells of your body for it to enter your body. And so you only have a limited time because it's flowing through you, right? You're going to lose it as feces if you don't absorb it. So the more folds you have, the more efficient you are at absorbing it. Similarly, for a fungus, the more branches and the more slender these branches are, the more overall surface of area of contact between the fungus and the food there is, and therefore the much greater efficiency at digesting and then absorbing the nutrients. The mushroom, if a fungus has a mushroom, which many do, that really is mostly a reproductive structure that grows later. The fungus starts out as a mycelium growing into the food. And fungi, by the way, are everywhere. You might not think about them every day, but you're interacting with them. You're in contact with them just like bacteria, basically, all the time. And you're eating them all the time. I'm not talking about the mushrooms that you intentionally eat. You're eating mold, and which is fungus, all the time. You know, for instance, if you... An orange, for instance, will sometimes develop a little green spot on it that you see as mold. And you might say, I'm not eating that orange. But by the time you see that green spot, which is like the mushroom, it's a fruiting body for the next generation, to make the next generation. By the time you see that, the mycelium, which is really the main body of the fungus, has already grown all the way through that orange. And the day before, when you didn't see that green thing yet, you would have eaten all of that fungus. You're eating it all the time. It's plants, which oranges are examples of, and fungi go hand in hand. That's why I said, that's why we're studying them together in this chapter. All right, let's go to 7 and look at that, one of the examples of this very close relationship between plants and fungi. In this cartoon, we see a fungus and a plant, or at least part of each of their bodies. The yellow stalk here is a fungal hypha. I just told you that the mycelium is made up of hyphae. This is one little hypha of that big network. And so the hypha is an end-to-end arrangement of cells. It looks like a little filament. The brown cells are the plant cells, but specifically, they are cells of the root of the plant underground. And notice that the fungal hypha grows right next to, right, it looks like it's growing into the cells of the plant, but it actually is not growing into those cells. The light brown, that's the thick layer there, that's the cell wall, right? That's not really inside the cell. Just inside that cell wall, though, is the plasma membrane, right? That would be this kind of orangish brown layer. And to actually enter the cell means you would have to pierce through the plasma membrane, right? Well, these little things that look like hands, those are branches of the hypha. That's part of the fungus. And they look like hands because of what we were just talking about. Having these little finger-like projections increases the surface area of contact between the fungus and the plant cell. But they don't actually pierce the plasma membrane. Notice the orangeness, which is the plasma membrane. That covers all of these fingers. You know, if you imagine trying to put your fingers into a water balloon, if you don't have sharp fingernails, you could do that, right? You're not actually entering the balloon, though. The balloon is going to wrap around your fingers. And you're going to have a lot of area of contact between you and the balloon. Same thing here. So it's not actually piercing, but there's a lot of contact. And therefore, there's a lot of ability for exchange of materials between the fungus and the plant, which is what they do. They each give the other things that the other needs. So this is another example of symbiosis. And more specifically, since it benefits both species involved, it is mutualistic symbiosis. They mutually benefit from this arrangement. And it's, you know, they both invaded land, they both came into existence on land about the same time, roughly 500 million years ago, 500 million years ago. And they've been evolving together the whole time. Now, this arrangement that we're looking at here between a fungus and a plant's roots is called mycorrhizae. Notice the same root as in rhizoid. That means the rhiz part means root. Myco means fungus. So the branch of biology that deals just with fungi is called mycology. A mycologist is a biologist who devotes his or her career to studying fungi. So mycorrhizae literally means fungus roots. And it's not one species, it's two, right? It's a plant, its roots, and a fungus that grows very closely together with it, symbiotically. Okay, slide 8. Another sexual, well, actually just life cycle here. I don't want to say sexual because it's a typical, there are exceptions to this, but many species of fungus can lead either asexual or sexual life cycle, and it can switch back and forth between them depending on conditions. So let's look at the sexual life cycle. Now, I told you a little bit ago that any sexual species is going to feature in its life cycle fertilization and meiosis, right? Well, you see meiosis, but you don't see a box that's labeled fertilization, despite what I just told you. I didn't lie to you, though. There is fertilization here. It's just that fertilization is broken into two parts. Let's think about more conventional fertilization like it happens in us. When sperm and egg meet, the two gametes for humans, two things have to happen. The two cells' cytoplasms have to join into one cytoplasm, and the two nuclei that get put into that cell, one nucleus from each gamete, have to also fuse to make one nucleus. And both of those things happen roughly the same time in most cases, including our own cases. And so that is overall what we call fertilization. Well, in many species of fungus, they don't happen at the same time. They both eventually happen, but at different times. And that's why you have two different words here, plasmogamy and karyogamy. The gamy part of that means coming together, which is why gametes are called that, because they come together. Plasmogamy means fusion of the cytoplasm. So when two fungal gametes, one from each of two different individual fungi, are fused together, you have one cell. It's one compartment, it's one plasma membrane now containing one cytoplasm, right? The two different cytoplasms of the two different gametes come together. That's what plasmogamy is. But now, for some time, you have one cell that has still two distinct nuclei in it. It got the two nuclei from the two different gametes, but the two nuclei have not yet fused. So during that time, however long it takes, the fungus is in the heterokaryotic stage. Well, what does the karyo of that word mean? Same root as in prokaryotic and eukaryotic, right? Which means what? The karyon root means, well, it means kernel or the core of something, but in the case of a cell, what it's referring to is the nucleus. And hetero means different, right? So heterokaryotic means having different nuclei. They're distinct still. They haven't fused yet. So plasmogamy is just part of fertilization. And then for some time, there's going to be two separate nuclei in that one cell. And then eventually, within that one cell, the two different nuclei fuse into one nucleus. That's the rest of fertilization. And that's called karyogamy, which literally means fusion of the nuclei. So it's just a more drawn-out way of accomplishing fertilization. But plasmogamy plus karyogamy combined makes up fertilization. Anyway, that's going to result in a zygote, right? A diploid zygote. Well, in us, that diploid zygote, which is a single cell, would undergo mitosis in order to become multicellular. That's why we are multicellular diploid individuals, right, as animals. But remember I said that fungi are like the converse of us, or the inverse of us, I guess is more appropriate. They spend their multicellular life as haploids. The zygote is diploid, and it does not make it past the single cell stage. It immediately undergoes meiosis to divide into haploid cells. And those haploid cells are the spores that are the beginnings of new individuals. Each spore is its own individual. And those spores will then undergo mitosis, labeled germination, that just means growing. Mitosis makes them multicellular, but it keeps them as haploid, right? Mitosis does not change the ploidy. They're already haploid, they just grow into multicellular haploids, adults. Okay, so that's the mycelium is the main body of the fungus, as we discussed before, made up of the hyphae. Well, if they switch into the asexual means of reproducing, they simply make spores out of their already haploid body. I mentioned this before. They don't have to undergo meiosis, or they can't, because they're haploid, right? So they make haploid gametes just by using mitosis to copy some of their cells to make dedicated gametes. And, spores here, they can be called gametes, though, in other books. Anyway, these spores then can undergo... Well, these spores, because this is the asexual part, are genetically identical to the parent, right? Because they were made by mitosis. Mitosis does not change the genetics. It just makes exact copies. So these spores are the children of this adult fungus, but they are genetically identical twins, and they will grow up to be genetically the same multicellular as the original parent. You only get different genetics if you enter the sexual part of the life cycle. So not every single species works this way in fungi, but a great many do. Like most of biology, there are exceptions if you look carefully. Anyway, let's go on to slide 9 and look at the tree of fungi. Like I said earlier, that animals, plants, and fungi all are clade, true clades. They're all monophyletic taxa. So this is the one tree of fungi. And you should notice something troublesome about this tree. What is it? Phylogenetically speaking, what's the problem with this? Yeah. Zygomycetes. Exactly. You have multiple lineages, more than two lineages springing from the same node, right? What do we call that? What's it start with? It's a word that means many cuts. We've talked about this multiple times as well. It's called a polytomy, right? And polytomies are not the truth, right? Because it doesn't happen that way. But we don't know which of the several possibilities there are is more true than any others, because we don't have the evidence. Or at least we didn't by the time this tree was drawn. I'm sure this tree has been revised since this book was published. But anyway, despite the polytomies, we can recognize five major groups of fungi within the overall tree. and those are the ones listed. Chytrids, zygomycetes, glomeromycetes, ascomycetes, and basidiomycetes. Now, in all of these cases except chytrids, the name includes MYC, which I already told you, as in myco, means fungus. Even chytrids are fungi, don't get me wrong. It's just that they don't have the MYC in their name. You also, though, in parentheses, have an idea of how speciose each group is. In other words, how many species it includes, which is an indication of what process leads to the increase in numbers of species in a group. What do we call that? I mean, it's speciation, but we have a special phrase referring to how many species are created from a lineage. Represented in trees I've shown you that flare out, the lineages get wider and wider. What is that called? It's called adaptive radiation. Remember the phrase? So the greater the number of species shown in parentheses, the more adaptive radiation has occurred in that group. Well, chytrids, not all that many species, only 1,000. Despite the small number, though, they are important group. Unlike the rest of the groups, the chytrids includes quite a big number of unicellular fungi, which I told you are called yeasts. They also are mostly aquatic. So unicellular, free-living fungi living in water. Zygomycetes is shown below that. You have a picture of an example for each of these. Also only about 1,000 species. These ones are more familiar to you, though, than the chytrids because, for instance, common bread molds, these things I've talked about that you're eating all the time, those are mostly zygomycetes. You probably recognize that picture. Probably something like that has grown in your refrigerator. Glomeromycetes, in terms of adaptive radiation, has been the least successful. Only 160 species, as you see. So by far the fewest number of species in this group. But despite that very small number, they are ecologically very important because those few species that are members of glomeromycetes are predominantly the species that form these mycorrhizae that I was just talking about, which are so important to the success of plants, to the health of plants. So that even though there's not many species, they're found wherever there are plants. They're all over the place. And then you get to ascomycetes, which is the biggest group. 65,000 species, roughly, that we've discovered so far, that is. The asco part of that, by the way, means sac. So ascomycetes literally means the sac fungi, because their fruiting bodies look like little sacs, as you see here. And basidiomycetes are the most familiar in terms of art. You know, you have various sculptures and stuff of mushrooms, and those are basidiomycetes. The basidio part means club. So the club fungi are the basidiomycetes, also really successful, 30,000, but only roughly half as many as the ascomycetes. Okay, anyway, those are major groups of fungi. Let's go back to plants now in slide 10. This is the single tree of plants, because I've told you that plants makes up a monophyletic taxon. And look at the timeline. Plants date back to about 475 million years ago. Like I said, toward the beginning of this current and latest geological eon, the Phanerozoic. That's when the world really started looking like the world we're familiar with. Before then, which is most of life's history, there were no big things living on land. Nothing at all living on land originally. It was all ocean. But then the first inhabitants of land were bacteria, the only thing that... bacteria and archaeans, the only things that existed, right? They're forming basically slimy surfaces, nothing familiar looking. Animals on land and plants on land and fungi on land, not until half a billion years ago. By the way, animals are older than plants as a group, which might not seem like it makes sense to you since we depend on plants. Well, we depend on producers. Not all producers are plants, right? And also, what a lot of people lose track of is that because we are terrestrial animals, we live on land, we tend to think that animals are defined by being on land. But that's not how we got our start. Animals started out in the ocean. And then only more recently came onto land, right? There's still plenty of animals in the ocean. Well, plants started out on land from algae that already existed. Those were the producers, along with bacteria, that the original animals relied on. Okay, anyway, 475 million years ago approximately is the ancestor to all plants. Now, if you look at the right edge of this tree, you see some important labels. The entire tree, as you see, is plants as a whole. But there are two major subdivisions in that overall tree of plants. And those are the non-vascular plants and the vascular plants. Fundamentally different, right? On the basis of whether or not they have vessels. Well, I've already told you that the non-vascular plants came first. They're simpler in structure. Once they were successful, then some of their descendants evolved into the vascular plants. But notice that another name for non-vascular plants, as I already told you, is bryophytes. So those are completely interchangeable terms. Bryophytes and non-vascular plants means the same thing. All right, and notice from the tree that they are the basal group, most like the ancestor. Still plenty of them around. They just still are small. And the modern common examples, like I said, are mosses, but also liverworts and hornworts. Those are all bryophytes. No vessels in them. Okay, the other major group is the vascular plants. Well, that came about, vascularity came about around 425 million years ago, as you see. So 50 million years of plant history before you have the first vascular plants. Once that happened, though, accidentally, like all evolutionary innovations are accidental, once that came into place, vascularity, that was a huge hit because it was such an advantage. For what I told you earlier, it allows plants to get big, and big is a big deal for plants because they can get closer to the sun. They can hog the sunlight. So that's why almost all extant species of plants, ones that you live with nowadays, are vascular plants, not bryophytes. But if you restrict your attention to just the vascular plants, then you can subdivide that subdivision again. Right? There are two major groups within the vascular plants, as you can see here. Those are the seedless vascular plants and the seeded plants. So bryophytes not only don't have vessels, they also don't produce seeds. Not all plants do produce seeds. That's an even more recent innovation evolutionarily than vascularity. Vessels came along first at node 2 in this tree. And then in just some of the descendants of those vascular plants, the other major innovation of the seed came about roughly 300 million years ago. All right, now the seed also was a big hit evolutionarily because it was so advantageous to have this highly desiccation resistant and digestion-resistant package. A seed is a package that really very well protects a growing embryo inside it. And that, since it's so resistant to damage and to drying out, it can be carried one way or another very, very far away from the original parent that produced it, and then turn into a new individual. Which means in this, if you think about the early history of land for multicellular organisms, that means there was a hell of a lot of territory to exploit, right? That no big things were living at yet. Seeds allowed plants to vastly expand their ranges. So that was a huge hit. And therefore, vascular plants are much more highly successful than non-vascular. But among the vascular plants, the seeded ones are especially successful. Most of the plants that you would think of just randomly naming them would not only be vascular plants, but they specifically would be seeded plants. Familiar examples of seedless vascular plants, though, are ferns. Lycophytes and ferns make up, you know, their vessel. They have vessels, so they can get big. In fact, there were huge forests of giant ferns long ago that dominated. They are vascular and can get big, but they don't produce seeds. They have free-living, swimming gametes that have to find each other and fuse for fertilization to happen. Seed plants itself, then, as a group, can once again be subdivided. And the two major types of seed plants are, as you see listed here, the gymnosperms and the angiosperms. Now, the word sperm here means seed. So it makes sense that the seeded plants, the two major seeded plant groups, have names that end in sperm. And, you know, that's what it means for us, too. That's why we say a man's seed. It's a sperm, right? But what about the prefixes here? Gymno, what about that? Do you know what that means? Well, what other word that you know starts with G-Y-M-N? Gymnastics, gymnasium as well, right? The gymno part of those words means naked. And the original gymnasium, which was ancient Greece, was a public place where you could go to exercise in the nude. The gymnasium. The naked arena, basically, is what it means. Nowadays, you go to things we still call gymnasium, but you have to have your clothes on or you get arrested. Anyway, gymnosperm means naked seed. And that's because in this group of seeded plants, the seeds that they produce are open to the surroundings. They are not produced in their own little chambers. The familiar living examples, most modern gymnosperms, are conifers, cone-bearing plants. Well, the seeds are on the little blades of the cones, exposed. So they're naked seeds. That's why they're called that. Angio, same root as in an angioplasty or an angiogram, for instance, means chamber. For angioplasty, the chamber is the blood vessel. But angio means chamber. And so angiosperms get named that because their seeds have little chambers that they develop in. Chamber-seeded plants, in other words. And these are the most highly successful of all groups. Seeded plants are already the most successful group, but angiosperms specifically are more successful than gymnosperms. So you name five plants randomly, at least four of them probably are going to be angiosperms. They are also known as the flowering plants. And the flower itself was a hell of an innovation. Only the angiosperms have flowers. There's really three major, we'll talk more about this in a different chapter, but I'll tell you that there are three major big deals about flowering plants. One of which is the flower. It's the so-called three F's of angiosperms. Flowers, which are hugely successful because they're advertisements, right, for other organisms, animals, to come by and do the work of pollinating the plant for them. They don't just leave it up to the wind. So the flower, that's one of the F's. Fruit, which only flowering plant produce. That's what flowers turn into, fruit. And then the third F, so-called F, is really only part of the word. The third F is double fertilization. So obviously they have fertilization like any sexual species, but they do it a special way called double fertilization that I'll get into in a different chapter, in fact, a different unit. All right, so that's the timeline and the major groups of plants. Let's just quickly look at some examples. These are all, in slide 11, these are all examples of bryophytes. So these, just like that other example I gave you, these are really close-up views. These are not big plants at all. They're mosses and hornworts and liverworts. But the next time you see moss, get down on your hands and knees and try to look very closely at that velvet. You'll see some detail even with the naked eye. Slide 12 gives you some photographic examples of seedless vascular plants. So these are vascular, but they don't produce seeds. Remember I said the most familiar example are ferns. You won't see any flowers growing from your ferns either, because they're not seeded plants. The lycophytes that are all their fellow seedless vascular plants have things that look like cones, but this is a totally different group compared to the conifers. Okay, an overall table that really compares these major groups that we just discussed. And it compares them on the basis of what's happening with respect to the sporophyte and the gametophyte generations. All plants have a sporophyte and a gametophyte generation because all plants have alternation of generations. So they have multicellularity in both the haploid and the diploid stage. All plants, even from the most primitive to the most modern. That's why you see that gametophyte and sporophyte is a row on each of these columns. But if you look at the original plants, which are the bryophytes, mosses and other non-vascular plants, that's just another name for bryophytes. In this column, what you see is that the gametophyte generation, which is the haploid generation, is the dominant of the two generations. Bigger than the sporophytes, even though they're both multicellular, the gametophyte is bigger, and the sporophyte depends on the gametophyte. Remember that picture I showed you? The sporophyte was growing out of the gametophyte's body. So it depends on the gametophyte. Well, that got switched once vascularity evolved onto the scene. So the next column is ferns and other other seedless vascular plants. All right, vessels but not seeds yet. Already by then, though, the role has switched. Now, gametophyte is always haploid and sporophyte is always diploid. But in ferns and other seedless vascular plants, the sporophyte generation is now dominant. And that's why when you see a fern, the thing you call the fern is the sporophyte. The gametophyte generation are these microscopically small things that need to swim around and find each other. Okay? See a cartoon version right here. Anyway, when you get to the most modern of these major groups, the seeded plants, it's still the case that the sporophyte generation is the dominant one, but even more so. The sporophyte is much, much bigger than the gametophyte generation, And even though it still qualifies as alternation of generations, which requires multicellularity in both generations, it's really stretching it at this point. Modern plants, seeded plants, gymnosperms and angiosperms, are just barely multicellular in the gametophyte generation. Remember I told you a little bit ago that you never really see the gametophyte generation in these because it's living entirely inside the sporophyte? But also, it's just barely multicellular, literally two or three cells big. So yes, technically that's multicellular, even though it's almost what we do. All right, let's go on to 14 and look at a seed. This applies, of course, only to the seeded plants that are the only ones with seeds. A seed, by the way, isn't called a seed until an important event happens, namely fertilization and then successful division, mitotic division of that zygote to become an embryo. So this thing might look like a seed to you on the left, but it's properly called an ovule at this point. It's an unfertilized ovule, and it's still part of the body of the sporophyte, but within it you have the gametophyte living, all right? Just a couple cells big. That's why you never see it. It's inside an ovule. If this ovule gets lucky enough to have the right kind of sperm be delivered to it via pollen grain, then fertilization can take place. And we'll look at the details of this in a different chapter. But if that occurs, and only if that occurs, is this thing ever going to be called a seed? It's still not technically a seed because all you have is a zygote at this point. But quickly after the zygote is successfully made, that single-celled zygote undergoes mitosis to become the next stage, just like for us, right? Which is the embryo. When you have an embryo, which is a multicellular structure, this is an embryo of the next generation of sporophyte. It's still in the body of the sporophyte two generations ago. So this is not like a mother carrying a child, right? That's just two generations. This is like a mother carrying a child with the grandchild still in that, all within the same body. Because a sporophyte contains the gametophyte generation, which became then, with fusion of the other gametophyte generation's gametes, an embryo of the next sporophyte generation. Is this all making sense? Only then do we call this thing a seed. And a seed is, like I said, very successful because it very well protects this embryo that is alive and growing, but sometimes just barely perceptibly. It has a metabolism, but it's basically close to zero metabolism until this seed gets the correct environmental cue telling it it's time to germinate, which depends on the species how long that takes, but it can take centuries before it finally, for instance, detects the heat of a forest fire, telling the seed, okay, now is your chance, because the trees that were big are now gone. It's your turn to grow now. So really, a very well-defined and protected package, which is why most plants are seeded plants nowadays. Oh, it's not only protecting it, it's locking in there a food supply for it to grow until it's able to make its own food via photosynthesis. It has to eat until that time. Okay, anyway, slide 15. These are just pictures of gymnosperms. Now, I just told you that most gymnosperms alive today are conifers, things like pine trees and fir trees. But there are also things that are within gymnosperms that don't look very much like the cone-bearing plants. These things are cones as well, but they're not exactly like most pine cones, for instance. And some of them have things that look like fruit, but these are not true fruit because only the flowering plants, the angiosperms, produce fruit. So Speaking of the angiosperms, slide 16 shows you a picture of a flower, in case you haven't already guessed that. Flower isn't the entire plant, that's just part of the angiosperm, but it's the big deal of angiosperms, one of those three Fs I was talking about. And I'm sure you don't have to be told that there is a tremendous variety of flowers. Sizes, shapes, colors, it's all over the place. They don't all look like this, obviously. This is just an idealized cartoon. But although we'll get back to this in a different chapter, let me tell you that a flower is a reproductive structure for the plant, for the flowering plant, the angiosperm, and it consists of four major parts, if they're all there. Not all flowers are so-called complete flowers like this one. It's a complete flower if it has all four major parts. Those parts are called whorls. And so the four whorls of a complete plant, which are all labeled here, are sepals, petals, carpels, and stamens. Now the sepals are just leaf-looking green things that really, when the flower is still a bud, that's just the enclosure. You see it as a green covering. And then when it blooms, the sepals open up and you see the petals, which can be any color, like I said, in any shape. The sepals and the petals, by the way, even though the overall flower is a reproductive structure, the sepals and the petals are sterile parts of the flower, meaning that they do not themselves directly produce gametes. The other two whorls are the fertile parts of the plant, not sterile. They're fertile because they do directly produce the gametes. And so, in a complete flower, there's male parts and female parts. The stamens, however many there are, and there's great variety in how these are shaped as well, those are the male parts. So they can look just about any way, but a lot of them have a slender stalk that ends in kind of a bulbous terminus that we call the anther. The anther is where pollen grains are manufactured by the billions. That's the male part. So pollen grains contain in them sperm cells, okay, which you'd expect for male. A complete flower also has female parts, though, which are called carpels. Now, this one shows just a single carpel. That's a possibility. You can also have more than one carpel or even zero if it's an incomplete flower. But anyway, it's not all carpels look the same either. There's a tremendous variety there. And this is a cutaway view, so this is the interior. But a lot of carpels have more or less a bowling pin shape with a base that is kind of bulbous that we call the ovary. Ovary is simply a place that makes eggs. Eggs are ova, right? An egg cell is an ovum, plural of ova. So an ovary is an egg factory, just like it is in a female human. So inside that are ovules, which really just means little eggs. Right? Those ovules, just like we saw on the previous slide, are the things that, if they become fertilized and start growing an embryo, will be called seeds officially. Ovules can turn into seeds, but only if fertilization takes place successfully. Well, anyway, above that is a kind of a slender stalk called the style, typically. And then at the free end, the unattached end, there is a stigma, which is a sticky surface. And why is it sticky? It's resinous, produces resin so that it's sticky. Why? On the stigma of the carpel. The carpel. It's sticky so that pollen grains from the male can stick to it. For fertilization to happen, We'll look at the details later, but for that to happen, a pollen grain of the right type has to land on that stigma and then burrow a tunnel all the way down into the ovary and find one of these ovules and deliver the sperm to it. Only then will it be a seed. By the way, remember I said the three F's? The flower, if things go right, fertilization-wise, will develop into a fruit. The ovary will become a fruit, and the ovules that are in that ovary will be the seeds in that fruit. That's what a fruit is, by the way, a seed-bearing structure. They're not all edible, by the way. We tend to think of fruits as things we would like to eat. There's a lot of fruit that you wouldn't think of eating, but they are, botanically, they're called fruit because what that means is seed-bearing device that came from a flower. Okay, 17. Well, we're back to looking at fungi again instead of plants. And specifically what we're looking at here are lichens. Now, have you heard of lichens before? Anyone? Okay, well, you might think of lichens as being a certain species. That's not what a lichen is. A lichen is not a single species. A lichen is another symbiotic relationship. But what we call the single lichen, whatever it is really a close living relationship between some sort of fungus and some sort of unicellular photosynthetic organism, which could be either an alga, a unicellular alga, or a cyanobacterium, a photosynthetic bacterium could be in there as well. But one of the two members of the lichen has to be photosynthetic. The other one is a fungus of some sort. And it looks like one organism to us macroscopically, but it's really two living closely together. And you recognize these, even if you haven't paid attention to them, you see these all the time. If you go hiking around, you see these colored things growing right on bare rock, like you see in the picture there. Which it seems like, how could anything live on just the surface of a rock? Well, they can because of the photosynthetic member of that lichen, right? That's producing the food out of the CO2 in the air. The fungus is being fed by the plant, but the fungus contributes, or not the plant, the photosynthesizer. The fungus is giving its contribution as well. Anyway, these are really important ecologically because by growing on the surface of these rocks, they help to break the rock down, to weatherize it. The weather itself helps, but the lichens growing into cracks also makes it into smaller and smaller chunks over long periods of time. And so that's how soils get created eventually. Breakdown of rocks into smaller rocks, into smaller rocks, until you have tiny sand-like pieces that are an important part of the soil. And you have to have soil for later then. Once soil's in place, then you can have big things like plants grow in it. You wouldn't have that if it weren't for lichens to begin with. All right. 18. This is another important ecological interaction involving fungi and plants. We talked already about mycorrhizae. This is similar, but it's also different. As I told you, mycorrhizae is really just living right up next to each other, not one living inside the other. But also, and that's in the roots, at the roots of plants. There are also fungi, though, that live inside of plants, like in the leaves of plants, which are above the soil, of course. And those are called endophytes. Now, remember I said that phyte means plant. But an endophyte is not a plant. Endophyte literally means within a plant, right? So an endophyte is the name of a fungus. It's not a specific species, but it's a type of fungus that lives inside a plant, like inside the leaves. And that's, once again, mutually beneficial. Helps the plant and it helps the fungus. The plant, of course, feeds the fungus. But as you see here, one way that the plant can benefit is by being protected from invading microorganisms. Pathogens are things that can do the plant harm. Well, in the graph here, we see leaf mortality, which is bad, right? The higher the number, the more leaves are dying, which is bad for the plant. Well, notice that it's much higher in the orange band, E minus P plus. That means the pathogen is there, P plus, but the endophyte is not there. The fungus is not there. If the fungus is not around, the pathogen does a hell of a lot more damage compared to the same pathogen present, but the endophyte or fungus also being there. The fungus produces things that protects the plant from the pathogen. Well, beneficial as some fungi are to plants, also, obviously, there are some fungi that are very bad for plants' health. And so there are pathogenic fungi for plants as well. And this is a huge loss of crops agriculturally. A lot of food goes wasted simply because we can't protect it from the fungi that invaded as pathogens. And so you see various kinds of spoilage here. That's also ecologically very important. For it to be ecologically important doesn't mean it has to be beneficial. It can be detrimental as well and be important. Slide 20. This is really just plants, not plants and fungi. We're looking at overhead views of a rainforest here. This is the same exact section of rainforest, but what is it, only 10 years apart? Yeah, 9 years apart. The one that's 9 years later, you see a hell of a lot more clear cutting. So the forests are being clear cut. The rainforests are being eliminated at an alarming rate, which is another one of these major bad news slides. Because you get rid of the producers, the consumers are going to go extinct, and that includes us. But it's lumped in here in this slide because plants obviously are really ecologically important as the major terrestrial producers. Not in oceans, because plants don't really live in the oceans, but the oceans have their own producers, right? Algae and cyanobacteria are major producers in the ocean. That leaves just 21. This is the final slide. And this also is kind of an ecology slide because it has to do with the fact that plants, flowering plants specifically, really are good examples of co-evolution. They are going down an evolutionary trajectory. They're evolving like anything else does. But the direction of evolution that they take really depends a lot on other species, because flowers came into existence as things that demand the attention of other organisms, right? They're, like I said, they're advertisements for pollinators. And therefore, since what those pollinators are doing, bees or whatever they are, is carrying gametes from plant to plant, they are affecting the mating success of plants and therefore really affecting their evolution. Well, here we have two different groups of flowering plants. Ones with bilaterally symmetrical flowers and ones with radially symmetrical. Now, bilateral symmetry is right-left symmetry, like our own bodies have, at least superficially, right? So there's a line that is the basis for bilateral symmetry, and it's a mirror image across that line. Radial symmetry, on the other hand, is defined by a central point, and the symmetry is in directions from that point outward, as you can see in the two pictures. Well, there are flowers of both types of symmetry, different species, different groups, many species of each. But anyway, if you imagine yourself a pollinator, like a bee, for instance, visiting either one of these kinds of flowers, you don't, as a bee, care at all about the plant's pollen. That's not why you're there. It's just an accident that you pick up the pollen. You're there to get the reward that the plant makes, right? The nectar. That's why they're lured. The color helps, but the nectar is really the payoff. So you're there to collect nectar. And if you come upon a bilaterally symmetrical flower, it's limited in how you can enter it, because you have to get deep into that flower in order to get the nectar. It only has basically one way to get in. Whereas a radially symmetrical flower, you can enter through any of several different entrances. All right? Does that make sense? Okay, well, if it's a bilaterally symmetrical flower, that means since you're entering the same way always, you're going to get pollen on your body the same way always. Which means when you carry it away, it's only going to be delivered properly to the other plant if you're also entering that flower the same way you entered the one you picked it up in. Otherwise, it'll be wasted pollen because it won't be fertilizing anything. And so what this means is that you would expect the bilaterally symmetrical group of flowers, flowering plants, to have less gene flow. They're more isolated, right? Remember, gene flow is movement of gametes between species, between populations. Well, because of this restrictive way that the pollinators can get in, you expect those gametes to stay within just that group, right? More isolated. Whereas radial symmetry, you'd expect a lot of gene flow. Well, remember what we talked about as far as gene flow in the speciation chapter, origin of species chapter? When you have a lot of gene flow between populations, then they remain the same species, right? It's when you cut off you cut off the gene flow between populations that they start, when they're isolated, in other words, that's when they start becoming their own species. So what the scientists doing the study hypothesized, therefore, was with less gene flow because of the restrictive way of entering these bilateral flowers, you would expect there to be more speciation in the bilateral clade because they're more isolated from each other. Whereas in the radially symmetrical clade, you expect to have less adaptive radiation, fewer species produced. And that's exactly what they saw. But that's all because of interactions between the animals and the plants. It's not just because of the plants themselves. So it's just a really good example of coevolution. Let me make sure that's the last slide.